Hello, and welcome to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're an independent bookstore with two locations in Brooklyn, New York, one in Fort Greene and one in Prospect Lefferts Gardens. Today we'll be listening to an event we had with social worker, author, and Greenlight Bookstore staff alumni, Eleanor Kreisman, about her new book, The Blurry Years. She is in conversation with author Julie Bunton. Enjoy.
Hi, everyone. I think I know pretty much everybody here, almost. So thank you guys for coming. And yes, my parents are here. So just remember that when you're asking questions. Yeah, I'm going to read a chapter that was a story first. So hopefully it should be interesting enough on its own. Also, the second sentence has Dunkin' Donuts in it, and you guys know how much I love that. The gas station bathrooms were always open, but if it wasn't the middle of the night and we had a choice, I liked Dunkin' Donuts better. The bathrooms there were cleaner, and if I crossed my legs and sort of hopped around, the people behind the counter would usually let me use it, even if we didn't buy anything. If we stopped for the night, we looked for 7-Eleven or someplace else that was always open because it was safer to park there. My mom would only sleep at night if she thought it was safe. Sometimes we drove all night and parked during the day. She'd sleep then, but I never could, even with a blanket over my face to block out the good light, or to block out the light. If my mom was in a good mood when we passed a welcome sign, she'd pull over so I could stand beneath it. The signs were always much bigger than I expected them to be when I got up close. Welcome to Ocala. Welcome to Gainesville. Welcome. We're glad Georgia's on your mind, with a giant peach in the corner. That was the first state line. Back in Florida, she pulled over at the sign for the Suwannee River so I could look over the railing at the water. It made me dizzy. The water was a long way down. We were headed to Oregon to stay with my Grandma June for a little while. That was all I knew. I kept asking questions at first. Why do we have to pack so quickly? Why aren't we saying goodbye to anyone? What about school? I stopped asking when she wouldn't answer. We were both quiet for a long time. The only time I complained was on that stretch of highway after Nashville when we just passed the rest stop and the AC had switched off again and wouldn't turn back on, even when I hit the dashboard and I kept asking her to turn around so I could use the bathroom. She wouldn't turn around, and instead she pulled over and made me pee in the sawgrass on the side of I-24. When I got back in the car, still damp between my legs because we didn't have any toilet paper, I said I'd wish we'd never left home. Me too, she said, and turned up the radio. It was weird how looking out the window of a moving car made me forget about a lot of things. I barely thought about my friends. I'd had plans to walk to Fox with Shauna later that week to buy a new pair of sandals. I barely thought about starting seventh grade, even though that was all me and Shauna could talk about before I left. Every time something like that popped into my head, all I had to do was stare out the window for a little bit, and it would just float out again. The only thoughts that stuck were the ones of home. My mom and Daryl at the kitchen counter, a bottle of anything between them, hysterical with laughter over something I pretended to understand. The frayed, pilling fabric of the couch that I picked at absentmindedly while watching television. The ceilings that looked like popcorn somebody had painted over. No matter how fast everything was going by outside the window, those thoughts didn't go away. She'd switched on my light, grabbed my suitcase from under the bed, and started pulling clothes from my dresser before I'd even sat up. "What's going on?" I asked, narrowing my eyes against the sudden brightness. She was drunk. Ever since the 4th of July, when she drifted off at the wheel, she hadn't been drinking, at least not around me. But that night she was drunk. "Take your favorite things," she said, tugging hard on the bottom drawer of the dresser, the one that always stuck. "We'll come back for the rest later. Just take what you want." The drawer came unstuck, sending her stumbling backward. I was half asleep and obedient and filled the suitcase easily. Tank tops, my white denim shorts, a soft old shirt of Daryl's that my mom used to sleep in. Underwear, flip-flops, my copy of Bridge to Terabithia, page folded down to mark my place, which was chapters ahead of where I was supposed to be. It was funny, the things I chose to bring, the things I forgot. I brought my toothbrush as if that were something inexpensive and irreplaceable. I forgot my friendship necklace, the golden best to Shauna's friends with the chain that turned my neck green if I wore it for too long. My mom stabbed at the ignition with the key and managed to get it in. She drove carefully, and we didn't go far, just to the IHOP near the interstate. I ate French toast like a robot while she drank a whole pot of coffee and ordered a refill. We stayed until the waitress started wiping the table to move us along. When we walked back out to the car, I noticed the bumper was slightly askew. The glass casing around the red headlight had been shattered. "What happened?" I asked, pointing. "Nothing," she said, staring at the car, tilting her head the same way as the bumper. "Nothing happened. Try to sleep in the car. It's late." Daryl wasn't with us, which was weird. My mom was always with him. But she always spent the night at home, even if she got back really late. We had barbecues a lot at Daryl's place. I would sit on his bench press machine, part of the outdoor gym he'd put together by scouting out the alleys of the rich neighborhoods on trash nights. He told that story a lot. I'd lean against the metal bar that rose from the bench and fiddle with the screws that held it together while I watched the men light the grill and the women unfold card tables on the patchy grass, setting out sliced watermelon and pasta salad and pitchers of sweet tea. Memorial Day had been the best. I'd seen my mom walk up behind Daryl while he was turning the hot dogs and put her arms around his waist and settle into his body, and instead of getting mad at her for surprising him, he leaned into her and smiled. In the flickering light from the grill, they looked like something I wanted to take a picture of. 4th of July had been the worst. I'd been excited to wear my new shorts, red and white stripes on one side, blue with white stars on the other, but they were made of that spandex denim that stretched out so much I had to keep hiking up the waistband to keep them in place. My mom had on a black halter top and lipstick the exact color of pink in the Baskin-Robbins logo. I thought she looked good. So did Daryl. When we got there, he looped her arm around her waist and told her so. But Daryl must have thought Charlene, who is a hostess at the Italian place Marcus managed, looked good too, because I saw him walk up next to her, telling her how much he loved her Coca-Cola cake, his flimsy paper plate buckling under the weight of the food he'd piled on, baked beans slipping off the side and onto the dirt. I walked over to Daryl and Charlene and swiveled my foot back and forth in front of them, making an indentation in the ground. Daryl didn't even notice as I kicked the spilled beans into the hole and covered them with the dirt. When my mom came back outside with a new coat of lipstick and another red plastic cup full of punch, she saw Daryl leaning into Charlene's story, and she grabbed his arm and dragged him behind the neighbor's place. Charlene shrugged her shoulders at Desiree, who was unwrapping packets of sparklers for the little kids. "I'm not getting messed up in all that," she said, hands to her chest, palms facing out. From next door, my mom's voice grew louder and louder until I heard the crack of an open palm on skin, then she came running for me. I'd been excited about climbing up to the roof of the trailer to watch the fireworks, but she grabbed my arm just like she'd grabbed his and speed-walked me to the car. It wasn't even all the way dark yet. On the drive home, I flicked the lock on the passenger side door up and down until I noticed we were drifting across the center line. I grabbed the wheel and jerked the car back into the lane, steering the rest of the way home while my mom worked the gas and brakes. I pinched her arm every once in a while to make sure she didn't close her eyes again. In bed later, I realized there had been no red mark on my mom's face, no handprint. She had slept Daryl. The next morning, she came into my room and crawled into bed with me just as the sky was getting light. "Do you think I'm a bad mom?" she asked. I was facing the wall. She was spooning me, still wearing last night's outfit. Her breath was hot on my neck. "No," I said after a minute, and I meant it, but I knew I should have said it quicker. I'm going to end there.
That was so good. Thanks, Eleanor.
That's such a good place to end reading, because if you don't want to buy the book after that, you are deranged and I don't understand you.
It was also earlier than I was planning to end it, but I was looking frantically for a good place that I could stop. So I
just sort of want to start things off with like a very broad and general question. I think one that writers don't like to get asked, but how did you come to this story and sort of like, what is this story to you for the people who haven't read the book? Callie kind of?
I think most of you here know me, but definitely not all of you have read it. That wasn't me being snarky or anything. Just it hasn't come out
yet. Just like a gentle.
But it started out as a story.
And that was from the story, what you just read.
It was a different chapter. Those were a couple of the first chapters that I wrote, and they were individual stories. And I was, I just kept writing this character. And I think a lot of her life is very different from mine, and it takes place in a different decade, different generation, but it's very much place-based. I don't think that I could have written something that took place anywhere other than my home state and what it feels like there.
Yeah, so it came sort of from that like original place memory or like sense memory of a place for you.
Yeah, I think that is sort of one of the strongest memories that I have. And then also I think adolescence is one of the times when you're one of the only times in your life when you can, you know, recall something that happened with such precision, like yeah. decades later.
Yeah. And the book, I mean, even from those of you who haven't read it, but from what Eleanor just read, like the clarity of the sensory details, even from the opening opening sentence when, Callie spills spaghetti onto the sheets and then can smell it like a few pages later. There's something you can remember about that, about adolescence. It's so visceral that I think you captured really well. Were you thinking about that as you kind of developed Callie's voice, like how to access that or?
I mean, honestly, I think that the middle chapters are like the best ones. So just like give it a chapter or two if you're not into it. But the middle chapters are probably the ones, it's chronological order. Mm-hmm. And so the middle chapters are more like that, like 11, 12, yeah. 13, 14, those years. And I think that, it's very easy to remember the physical feeling of being those ages, even if the circumstances of, Callie's life are very different from mine.
Yeah, and it makes sense, too, considering that sometimes Callie's in traumatic situations that, like, what we're seeing are these really precise sensory details that give us, like, a really rooted sense of what's going on, even if the reader sometimes struggling to understand with Callie, like, how to make sense of this larger scenario. I'm curious about kind of the process of writing the book. You, when I first met you, were working in publishing for Megan Lynch at Echo, which is, like, a big-time job. And I'm interested in how that job and how your proximity to so many debut writers and like the publishing world, did it have an imprint on how this book took shape, or was it kind of already done? Like, was there a relationship between the development of the writing and who you kind of were at work?
I think that, well, maybe my coworkers and writers that I've worked with, who I also see here, can answer that better. But now I feel like I have been on all sides of this industry now. I worked here, I worked as an editor, I worked at a literary agency, and so now it's sort of like I've seen it from every other side. I think that's probably why I'm this anxious, just because I know everything that goes into making a book and into selling it and how much work everybody puts in that isn't the author. But I think that being, not so much being in publishing, but editing actually helps me be a better writer tremendously. No matter what I'm working on, I feel like I absorb some of the lessons that I try to help other people with.
Did you ever have any like experiences where you were editing someone else's work and then you were like, oh shit, I've got to do this to mine now? Like, did you have any, like, was there any kind of like back and forth between that process in a specific way?
Not specifically. I think I just would read a lot of really good writing and be like, oh God.
Yeah. I think it's like a blessing and a curse to work as an editor and also like be a writer, because you have to submit yourself to the same like rigor, but you also know what sucks in a little bit of a different way. So you're like, oh, this isn't good because it's a first draft, but you're like working with stuff that's really good. And it's like, ooh. I just admire that you were able to kind of handle those things. And maybe not to talk about day jobs too much, but like, so were you in some email exchanges that we had outside of this room, we talked a little bit about how you've had like intense jobs the whole way through, kind of becoming a writer. How did you manage that with your writing life? And like, when did you write this book? In Stolen Time, or did you find time in some other way? You don't have an MFA, right?
No.
So tell me about how it kind of came together out of the spaces of your life.
Well, a lot of it actually I wrote while living with Lily, friend and former roommate. So, but I actually think that I function better when I have other things to do. And so I don't have a job now, so you can hire me if you're looking for a school social worker. But it actually is very grounding to have other things to do, especially things that aren't writing. So the further that a task is from that, the easier I think it is to dedicate other swaths of your life to doing it. But I started this when I was in college and working here, and then wrote probably the bulk of it while I was working in publishing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just like finding the time before and after work and
making
it happen.
Yeah.
Cool. So I think one of the major accomplishments of this book is like this masterful first person that you get such a rich sense of Callie Calliope, like as a person in different moments of her life. And then also the register of the first person changes as Kelly grows up. And I'm wondering about that kind of like modulation of voice. How did you do that? Like, tell us how you were able to kind of capture her thinking as it matured, and especially in relationship to her mother. That's a huge question, but...
Well, I hope that I did do that, because I know that I'm just calling all of you guys out to help with my nerves, but there's at least one person in this room who doesn't like books with child narrators. But I'm really interested in...
Who is it? Okay, sure. I can tell me after. I feel like I know just from how you reacted. I knew it was. Okay, go on.
But I'm really interested in the way that children's minds work and the way that thinking evolves. And so I wanted to see if I could write something from someone's point of view who was that young and not have it be like obnoxious or too overly
or
simplistic so I think I made it more mature than it would be with actually someone that young talking, but I guess trying to think about like what you would actually focus on when you're that young.
Yeah, I think it's the sensory details that make it feel so realistic. It's like this follow through of like how things feel, even in what you, again, just because it's what we've all heard just now, what like fiddling with the tire thing. And then it really struck me how like something's tipped over and then a smell comes back. It's this like real reliance on the concrete physical world that makes it feel believable to me. But you also told me that you have been working with some young people as part of your job now. Did that change at all how you thought about Kelly's voice, or did you inflect it with any more like teen sensibility at that point, or like even note anything you would do differently?
It was already pretty much done mm-hmm. when I started working with kids, and thankfully I didn't look back on it and think, oh God, I got this totally wrong. But it is... I think I was always learning in the last 2 years. I was working at a middle school and then at a high school, and just hearing what sorts of details kids pick out and what they think is most important to tell you, that is further shaping the way that I would write, the way that I would write another character like that.
Do you want to write it up from another like child narrator point of view, just to torment the person who?
I have no idea
what you're going to do next. Yeah. I won't ask you any more about it. So another kind of, this isn't really a spoiler, but it's sort of beautiful. There's a beautiful section towards the end of the book where Callie's sort of like meditating on growing up being a process of like putting the fragments of memory together to sort of assemble a self. I'm paraphrasing. The way it's written is it's really beautiful. And it also seemed to me like this kind of incredible little distillation of the structure of the novel, which is this sort of like vignette, these vignettes that come together to shape a person on the page. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that, because that's actually like you set two really challenging things in place here, like a child narrator growing older over the course of a book, and then also this kind of structure that hangs together on like lived experience, this character's lived experience. And sometimes that doesn't always have a shape that's like narratively momentous, but you made it so. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that. Like, how did you put the pieces of the book together, and did you always know it was going to be chronological, and how did you make those choices?
They weren't very deliberate. I think I started with one of the middle chapters. The middle chapters were probably some of the first ones that I wrote, and I didn't write them with the intention of it becoming a book. And then I kept writing from this character's point of view, and then eventually thought, oh, I could put these in order, and this might actually make some sense. I actually thought of it as a collection of linked stories, but if anyone here is in publishing, you will know that that's not something somebody wants to buy. It's not how you frame it. So that is still kind of how I think of it. But I definitely, once I arranged it in chronological order, went through and made sure that like there were some threads that, or some things that were continuous throughout it, so that it would tie it together more.
Yeah, so you kind of, it was like almost some imposed after that first draft, a kind of like tightening and reconfiguring or turning up of certain things. Yeah, it really, it's beautiful how the different resonances of certain characters and Callie's relationship, how like her relationship with her mother kind of is the through line, and then these other characters come into play. And I want to ask you too about the relationship between Callie and her mother, because it's really emotional and powerful, and also another kind of tricky thing to pull off, a character who we see only through the child's eyes doing things that are kind of like unforgivable, and yet you still have to develop some sympathy. So like who is she to you, the writer? Like, how did you come to her, and did she change or ever like surprise you in the writing of the book?
Well, she is not my mom, as, like everybody who knows my mom here, knows. But I think that she is sort of a, just like a distillation of like other memorable emotional experiences, that I've had or have written, and I did write actually a couple chapters from her point of view, and ended up cutting them because it didn't really make sense in the end to have them. But I did. It was really important to me that she also be someone that the reader likes or feels compelled to know more about or sympathizes with. Because it's not an interesting story if you just have a villain.
Yeah, she can't just be, and she isn't. Like, she has to be someone who, I was fascinated by how we get this sense of her through Callie's eyes, but also kind of the shape of her beyond that. Like, you know that there's a different, another story there, like, pressing up against what Callie sees, and I thought it was handled really, really well. Another thing I wanted to ask you about, and you kind of just touched on it in your answer, is like, I think I have sort of an axe to grind about this, but I think this happens to women writers a lot, where you write something in first person that's conceived, very fully conceived and emotionally written and emotionally felt, and people assume that you are the narrator, because how else could you have written such a thing? Have you come across this like presumption of autobiography with this book, and do you have a response to that or any kind of thoughts about why that happens in the world to writers like us?
Yes, I have. Yes, it has happened. I think that actually the reason that I said it in like the 70s, 80s is actually because I don't like writing characters with cell phones. So I was like, oh, I could just not even worry about that if I push it back a couple decades. But that has also, I think, helped a lot more, I imagine, with your book, because it is set more in the present, that you probably get even more of that. I think that it happens because people don't get fiction.
I agree. And it's such a confusing thing. I mean, even like, how do you explain it?
But I also think that that it does happen to women writers more than male writers, and maybe that's because, in a broad generalization, women writers give a lot more of the interiority of characters, or tend to put a lot more of the unspoken stuff about characters into
that's really interesting.
Into those, their narrators, also because I think people don't think that women can like have these imaginations that are like, whoa, this is totally not your life at all.
I always think it's a little like that too. It's like, oh, that she can't write fiction though. She must just be like working through some shit. That's why she had to do this thing.
Someone that I actually asked for a blurb, who I really, really love, wrote something really nice back to me and then said, I'm so sorry.
It's the greatest compliment, though, actually. It's condescending as shit, but it's, sorry, whoever that person is, but it's a great compliment about the reality of what you've evoked on the page, like that they believed it to be true. Yeah. I mean, because that's what we're trying to do, right? I mean, make it feel true.
Right. I want people to believe that this is a true thing that happened, but that it's, I didn't write it, that this person wrote it.
Yeah. So I want to ask one more question that might be sensitive with parents in the room, but I'll ask it delicately. Another thing I love about this book is how, in with so much, again, like sensory detail and rawness, yeah, that's a word. It really tackles female desire and sort of female adolescent sexuality and physicality, and also this idea of like women being in control. Kelly sometimes thinks she's in control of her body, and sometimes is like a victim of her own ideas of control. I mean, it's a really complicated thing that you manage to handle, and I'm really curious about just like why you were interested in that topic as a writer, and any also to kind of the craft behind it.
Well, I like the way that you put that a lot. The like victim of her own ideas about being in control. I think that a lot of that is even, you know, just growing up in as a girl and as a teenage girl in a place that is so much, and it's so hot all the time. So you're like constantly aware of yourself and your body, and you know, there's just a lot of imagery of bodies. Like, you know, when you think Florida, you think beach, you think swimsuits, you think
like skin,
summer, and so that has always been interesting to me, because I have always felt, and all of my friends growing up too, you know, we were so hyper aware of our bodies and our place in the world and our own ideas of ourselves, however inaccurate and flawed and skewed they might be. And I noticed that in the teenage girls that I work with now, you know, it's something that doesn't change. And it's most intense at that point in your life, I think.
Yeah.
So it's always just fascinated me because it feels ever present for a really long time.
Yeah. And it's really so interesting too, like the tension between how it's embodied in the narrator, but also like what she sees about other women, like what she sees in other people's bodies too. This kind of friction between those two things is, like, for me, was one of the main like sources of tension in the book. I want to ask, and again, like you've touched on it kind of throughout, but Florida, like the book came from Florida, you said sort of in the beginning, and it's been kind of a touchstone, I think, in a lot of your answers. And I'm curious, like, Florida's become sort of like a literary idea and also like a meme. It's like both things at once. What does that mean to you as like a writer of this place, and also like adding your debut novel to that conversation about what Florida is and like what it stands for?
I mean, I think that there are a lot of amazing writers who have written about Florida or have come out of Florida. My friend Sarah Gerard, her most recent book, Sunshine State, was a really great essay collection that I think touched on some things that people don't always think about when they think about Florida. I think that the people who take time to go beyond the meme aspect of Florida are the ones that actually come up with the most interesting stuff, because it is a weird place, and it's I was born there, I was raised there, I grew up there, and I had a different, you know, I didn't go to the beach all the time. I really didn't like the beach that much, still don't. But it's always there. It's always as an idea.
There's that great part where Callie's mom's like, go to the beach. Why don't, it's a mile away. And she's like, ugh.
Yeah. I think that the people who explore the parts that aren't necessarily the most obvious parts, are the ones who come up with the most interesting stuff. Like the fact that it takes, I don't know any of this, where any of the states in the Northeast are, because all I know is like it takes 8 hours to drive from like Tampa to hit the first state line. And so like that sort of stuff informs my thinking.
Yeah. In like every way.
Probably. Yeah.
I think on that note, I want to make sure that we have time for people from the audience who I'm sure have questions to ask them. If anyone does, I will repeat your question if you ask it. So the question was, what about this particular story made it like feasible to expand into a novel?
I think probably the similarities, just on the surface between the main character and me, like I wasn't writing about any ages that I haven't been. And I, for the most part, wasn't writing about any places that I haven't been. So just having a couple essential biographical similarities made me feel like I had enough authority to like keep on writing about it. Yeah. Keep making stuff up. Yeah.
Yeah, authority is an interesting thing to point out. Like it's so much of writing a novel does seem to be about like saying I can do this and I'm allowed to and I get to and it's mine. I mean, did you struggle? It sounds like you found a way to not struggle with that, but did you ever struggle with it at very, like, were there any like dark days? Tell us the worst thing about writing this book.
I always struggle with that. Yeah, I mean, I don't really ever feel like I have the authority to do anything. So authority was a good choice of word, but I think that having some of those things to fall back on my imaginary accusers are like, why you're not allowed to do this, then I have like then I have the things that I do know and that I have known from real life to fall back on.
Yeah, like I saw this, I know what it's like there.
Yeah.
Any other questions from the audience? Do you think that being able to write about Florida had something to do with being distant from Florida?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I think that I might have always felt a little distant from it, even when I was there. My mom is confirming that. But I do think that having being in the environment that I was in, sometimes being in the sort of opposite situation, like being in my small apartment in New York in the winter, like writing while the saran wrap is taped over the windows to make it warmer inside. Maybe the sort of contrasts actually brought out a lot of the things that I had always taken for granted and not noticed as much while I was there.
Makes sense. I saw someone else's hand flicker at the same time that Ruman's did. The question was if Eleanor ever went to school with or had knew anyone growing up who might have had a more challenging life that inspired some of the details of this story. Right?
That is also a great question. I don't think that I consciously thought about that while I was writing it, but you know, I'm sure that there were kids that I knew or friends that I had whose lives might have been more similar to the life that Callie leads, and I think I also took details from any sort of snippets of lives that were not my own that I was exposed to just by virtue of knowing someone or hearing something. But yeah, I don't think that I was consciously thinking that, but I'm sure that I did it.
Do you have a favorite scene that you could tell us a little bit about or how it came to you?
Well, like I said, the middle part's like the best part. There's like a lot in the middle, so that part is like all the best part. But there's actually a scene I didn't read from today, but that one of the only chapters that doesn't take place in Florida, and it takes place in somewhere in Oregon that I've actually never been. And I didn't read it because it didn't feel like it was the appropriate thing to read tonight. But I actually liked having to do a different kind of research to see like what was this place like in 1979 in a state that I've never been to, in a city that I've never been to, and looking up sort of the architecture and the feel of the place. So I actually like that a lot because I did a lot more explicit work to conjure up that scene.
That makes me wonder, like, what about a character? Were there any characters that kind of like really sprang to life for you outside of Callie and her mother, like sort of outside of that central relationship?
I think that there's one character who she's actually one of the characters that you meet in Oregon, but one of the mother's friends, and she is a hairstylist, and she has, in what seems like one of the more improbable scenes in the book, but it's actually something that a detail I did take from real life, has sinks for that purpose set up in her house. And if I remember correctly, the woman that my grandmother got her hair done from for years also had that set up in her house, and I was fascinated by it, and so that is very much comes from that.
That's really good. We have time for about one more question if anyone else has anything they want to ask Eleanor. The question was, what books are influences?
I knew this was going to be a question, I just didn't even think about it, but I will say that I think that Lori Colwin has been a big influence on me, hopefully in my writing, but just sort of in the way that I think about people and think about the world. And I will gladly hand sell you any of these books after. Lori Moore, of course, but then also Miriam Taves, which I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name right, but she is a writer. She's from Canada, and she was born into a Mennonite community. And one of her first novels is called A Complicated Kindness. And it also is narrated by a teenage girl who's going through some of the same sort of existential angst and questioning, and it's very darkly funny and just really poignant and well done, and I would love to think that I could come anywhere near that. But anyway, hopefully it's in stock, but it's really good. I would say that probably is someone that I would hope to write like.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. Books are for sale up front, and Eleanor will sign them for you after.
Thanks for listening to our event featuring Eleanor Kreisman and Julie Bunton. The Blurry Years is available at our stores or online at greenlightbookstore.com. If you like this podcast and want to hear more, subscribe on iTunes or look up individual episodes on our website. Also, be sure to rate us on iTunes and find and tag us on social media at greenlightbklyn. This podcast is brought to you by the customers of Greenlight Bookstore, who through Shopping Independent make free programming like this available. And if you're not local, be sure to look up your independent bookstore on indiebound.org. We hope you enjoyed this chat and to see you again soon. Thanks for dropping by.